A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Labyrinth of Evil by James Luceno. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. Darkness was encroaching on Cato Nymordia's western hemisphere, though exchanges of coherent light high above the beleaguered world ripped looming night to shreds. Well under the fractured sky, in an orchard of Manax trees that studded the lower ramparts of Viceroy Gunray's majestic redoubt, companies of clone troopers and battle droids were slaughtering one another with bloodless precision. A flashing fan of blue energy lit the undersides of a cluster of trees, the lightsaber of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Attacked by two sentry droids, Obi-Wan stood his ground, twisting his upraised blade right and left to swat blaster bolts back at his enemies. Caught midsection by their own salvos, both droids came apart with a scattering of alloy limbs. Tumbling under the segmented thorax of a Nymordian harvester beetle, Obi-Wan sprang to his feet and raced forward. Explosive light shunted from the Citadel's deflector shield dappled the loamy ground between the trees. Oblivious of the chaos occurring in their midst, columns of the 5-meter-long harvesters continued their stalwart march toward a mound that supported the fortress. From off to Obi-Wan's left came a sudden click of servos. To his right, a hushed cry of warning.
Down, Master!
He dropped into a crouch even before Anakin's lips formed the final word. A blur of thrumming blue energy sizzled through the humid air, followed by a sharp smell of cauterized circuitry, the tang of ozone. A blaster discharged into soft soil. Then the stalked, elongated head of a battle droid struck the ground not a meter from Obi-Wan's feet.
You nearly took my head off.
Anakin held his blade to one side. In the strobing light of battle, his blue eyes shone with wry amusement. Sorry, Master, but your head was where my lightsaber needed to go.
I suppose I should be grateful your lightsaber needed to go there, rather than desired to.
Obi-Wan swept his lightsaber in a flourishing pass, nodding up the alley of Manax trees. After you. They resumed their charge, moving with the supernatural speed and grace afforded by the Force. They jinked right, somersaulting under the wide bodies of two harvester beetles. They emerged from the tree line at the shore of a broad irrigation canal, fed by a lake that delimited the Nymordian Citadel on three sides. In the west, a trio of wedge-shaped Acclimator-class assault cruisers hung in scudding clouds. North and east, the sky was in turmoil, cross-hatched with ion trails, turbo-laser beams, hyphens of scarlet light streaming upward from weapons emplacements outside the Citadel's energy shield. Rising from high ground at the end of the peninsula, the tiered fastness was reminiscent of the command towers of the Trade Federation core ships, and indeed had been the inspiration for them. Somewhere inside, trapped by Republic forces, were the Trade Federation elite. With his homeworld threatened, and the purse worlds of Deco and Korru Nymordia devastated, Viceroy Gunray would have been wiser to retreat to the Outer Rim, as other members of the Separatist Council were thought to be doing. But rational thinking had never been a Nymordian strong suit, especially when possessions remained on Cato Nymordia the Viceroy apparently couldn't live without. Backed by a battle group of Trade Federation warships, he had slipped onto Cato Nymordia, intent on looting the Citadel before it fell. But Republic forces had been lying in wait, eager to capture him alive and bring him to justice, 13 years late in the judgment of many. Cato Nymordia was as close to Coruscant as Obi-Wan and Anakin had been in almost 4 standard months. And with the last remaining Separatist strongholds now cleared from the core and colonies, they expected to be back in the Outer Rim by week's end. Obi-Wan heard movement on the far side of the irrigation canal. An instant later,
Four clone troopers crept from the tree line on the opposite bank to take up firing positions amid the water-smoothed rocks that lined the ditch. Far behind them, a crashed gunship was burning. Protruding from the canopy, the Lat's blunt tail was stenciled with the 8-rayed battle standard of the Galactic Republic. A gunboat glided into view from downstream, maneuvering to where the Jedi were waiting. Standing in the bow, a clone commander named Cody waved hand signals to the troopers on shore and to others in the gunboat, who immediately fanned out to create a safe perimeter. A few nimble leaps brought Cody face to face with Obi-Wan and Anakin.
Sirs, I have the latest from Airborne Command.
Show us, Anakin said. Cody dropped to one knee, his right hand activating a device built into his left wrist gauntlet. A cone of blue light emanated from the device, and a hologram of Task Force Commander Dodonna resolved.
Generals Kenobi and Skywalker, Provincial Recon Unit reports that Viceroy Gunray and his entourage are making their way to the north side of the redoubt. Our forces have been hammering at the shield from above and from points along the shore, but the shield generator is in a hardened sight and difficult to get at. Gunships are taking heavy fire from turbolaser cannons in the lower ramparts. If your team is still committed to taking Gunray alive, you're going to have to skirt those defenses and find an alternative way into the palace. At this point, we cannot reinforce. Repeat, cannot reinforce.
Obi-Wan looked at Cody when the hologram had faded. Suggestions, Commander? Cody made an adjustment to the wrist projector, and a 3D schematic of the redoubt formed in midair.
Assuming that Gunray's fortress is similar to what we found on Deco and Koru, the underground levels will contain fungus farms and processing and shipment areas. There will be access from the shipping areas into the mid-level grub hatcheries, and from the hatcheries, we'll be able to infiltrate the upper reaches.
I agree that we can probably reach the upper levels, Commander, Obi-Wan said. But how do you propose we reach the fungus farms to begin with? Cody stood to his full height and pointed toward the orchards.
We go in with the harvesters.
Despite their two pairs of powerful legs and the sawtooth pincers that extended from their lower mandibles, the broad-bodied harvesters were single-minded creatures, complacent except when threatened directly. From their flatheads sprouted looping antennae, which served not only as feelers, but also as organs of communication by means of powerful pheromones. Each beetle was capable of carrying 5 times its considerable weight in foliage and branches. Similar to the Nymoidians who had domesticated them, their society was hierarchical and included laborers, harvesters, soldiers, and breeders, all of whom served a distant queen that rewarded effort with food. Obi-Wan, Anakin, and the commandos who made up Squad 7 had to run to keep up with the beetles as they hurried their fresh-picked loads from the orchard to the cave-like entrance to a natural mound at the base of the redoubt. The beetles' carapaces afforded them cover from surveillance sorties by battle droid stat patrols. More important, the harvesters knew safe routes through mined stretches of cleared ground that separated the trees from the fortress itself. The beetles' frequent habit of lowering their heads to exchange information with hive mates moving in the opposite direction demanded that the Jedi and troopers keep between the harvesters' rear legs. Hunched over, Obi-Wan ran with his lightsaber in hand, but deactivated. As the shielded royal residence came into view, a certain uneasiness seemed to take hold of the creatures, disrupting the ordered nature of their columns. In response to the crisis, soldier beetles were joining the procession, quick to shepherd nervous strays back into line. Anakin's greater height required him to remain farther back, almost directly under the beetle's pug tail. To Obi-Wan's right ran Cody, with his teammates trailing behind and flanking him. Soldier beetles or no, discipline was breaking down fast. A harvester, providing cover for one of the commandos, veered from the column before it could be guided back into line. Obi-Wan felt a ripple in the force an instant before the harvester's right foreleg tripped a landmine. A potent explosion fountained from the rocky ground, blowing away half the creature's foreleg. The commando threw himself to one side, rolling out from under a trio of pounding legs, only to have to bob and weave as the harvester began to run in frantic circles, seemingly determined to trample the commando underfoot. The harvester's distress was having an impact on the rest of the beetles. While most were pressed tightly together, others were suddenly scurrying away from the main column, sending the soldier beetles to high alert. Tripping two mines in succession, a second harvester was lifted off the ground by the ensuing explosions. With that, the column dissolved into disorder, with harvesters and soldiers running every which way, and commandos and Jedi alike doing their best to protect themselves. "Stay close to the ones who are still headed for the nest!" Anakin shouted. From the brood rose a shriek so high-pitched as to be barely audible, and a stampede was underway. Mines began to detonate to all sides, and out from billowing smoke above the orchard canopy swarmed more than 100 steps. A Nymoidian version of the agile repulsor lift airhook used as an observation vehicle throughout the galaxy. Each single trooper aerial platform was equipped with twin blasters that delivered more firepower than the stubby-barreled models carried by infantry droids. From maximum range, the swarm rained energy bolts on everything in sight, dropping harvesters in their tracks and turning the rocky ground into a killing field. Explosions erupted in jagged lines as scores of mines were detonated. Cody motioned everyone into a shallow irrigation trench just short of the mound. By the time Obi-Wan arrived, the troopers were deployed in a circle and continuing to pour fire into the sky. Anakin slid into the trench a moment later. A sudden noise from above caught everyone's attention. Scores of boulder-sized objects were spewing from openings in the lower ramparts of the fortress. Cody pressed a pair of macro binoculars to his eyes and gazed upward.
"That's no ordinary avalanche."
Cody passed the glasses to Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan raised the glasses and waited for the lens to autofocus. Rolling toward the trench at better than 80 kilometers per hour were some of the most feared of the Separatists' infantry arsenal. Droidicus. "Comm fire support for an artillery strike," Anakin ordered Cody. "Do it now." The commander called for his comm specialist, who splashed through the shallow water and flattened himself alongside Cody. When the spec had provided needed coordinates, Cody opened a frequency to the fire support base and spoke in a rush.
"To FSB from Squad 7. We're taking continuous fire from Staps in Sector Genth back to Ion, and are about to be buried under destroyer droids deployed from the readout. Request immediate artillery support at coordinates accompanying transmission. Recommend tactical electromagnetic pulse airburst followed by SVAT barrage."
The assistant squad leader moved his right hand through a series of gestures. When the gestures had been repeated down the line, the commandos removed their helmets and began to deactivate the electronic systems built into their armor. To a clone, they hunkered down in the fetid water. A screaming came from the south. Then, a nova bright flare of white light, followed 2 seconds later by a roar that turned Obi-Wan's eardrums to mush. What harvesters remained alive ran in dizzying circles, spilling their precious loads. Now from the south came an infernal wail, as SPHA-Ts, the Republic's walking artillery, loosed lasers on those droidicas that had survived the pulse weapon. Still without helmet, Cody stood up, signaling with both hands. Obi-Wan interpreted the gestures. 60 count, then suit up and break for the entrance to the nest. For all their reliance on droids, for all their infatuation with high technology, for all their inborn cowardice, greed, and guile, Nymoidians had a soft spot for their youth, their 7 formative years as grubs. The fungus foodstuff of those early years was as dear to them as adults as it was to them as hatchlings. And no wonder, since it was that same fungus that had found favor with species galaxy-wide, and from which the Nymoidians had evolved into a wealthy spacefaring society. Elsewhere, during the sieges of Deco and Koru Nymoidia, Obi-Wan had never visited a fungus farm. But no sooner had he and Anakin dashed through the cave-like opening to the nest than the briefings he'd received more than 10 standard years earlier came back to him in a flash. Here were the partly masticated leaves, carefully arranged in layers, the clumps of branches and other impurities, the laborer beetles, the droid overseers, the conveyors and similar contraptions devoted to sorting and transport. Not a Nymoidian in sight, but that was consistent with their doctrine that exertion of any sort was anathema. Cody ordered the squad to secure the area. Those in the rear were still taking sporadic fire from Staps. But the droid pilots couldn't get close to the entrance because of the bodies of dead beetles piled outside. Squad 7's medspec hurried over to Obi-Wan and Anakin.
Sirs, I recommend you keep your rebreathers close at hand. Odds are we won't have to penetrate any deeper into the nest, but there's always a chance of encountering free-floating spores in other areas.
Obi-Wan quirked his brows together. Toxic, Sergeant?
No, sir. But the spores have been known to have an adverse effect on humans.
Adverse how? Anakin asked.
The effect is most often described as dislocating, sir.
Obi-Wan glanced at Anakin. Then I suggest we do as he says. The fingers of his left hand were prizing the small, twin-tanked rebreather from its pouch on his utility belt, when a volley of blaster bolts streaked into the grotto. Caught in their upper chests, two troopers were knocked off their feet. The source of the sudden fire was the mouth of a narrow side tunnel that could be sealed by an overhead door. Anakin was already racing for the tunnel, lightsaber gripped in both hands, deflecting most of the bolts back through the entrance. Obi-Wan leapt to one side, raising his blade to deal with two bolts that got past Anakin. The first he returned toward its source. The second he parried at a deliberately downward angle. Striking the grotto's hard-packed floor, the deflected bolt ricocheted to one wall, then to the ceiling, to the other wall, and back to the floor, from which it caromed squarely into the control panel that operated the tunnel door. Showering sparks, the device shorted out, and a slab of thick alloy dropped from its pocket in the wall, sealing the tunnel with a loud thud. Switching off his lightsaber, Anakin cast a complimentary glance over his shoulder. Nicely done, Master.
General Kenobi,
the comm spec said from across the grotto.
Provincial recon reports that Viceroy Gunray and his entourage are heading for the launching base. They're protected by super battle droids.
Anakin swung to Obi-Wan. One of us has to divert the droids.
One of us?
Obi-Wan repeated.
Haven't we been through this before?
The beauty of our partnership, Master. You lure the bodyguards away. I capture Gunray. It hasn't failed us yet, has it?
Obi-Wan compressed his lips. From a certain point of view, Anakin.
Anakin scowled.
Fine. Then I'll be the bait this time.
That makes no sense, Obi-Wan said quickly. We play to our separate strengths.
Anakin couldn't restrain a smile.
I knew you'd listen to reason, Master. He singled out four commandos. You'll come with me.
Sir,
they said in unison. Obi-Wan, Cody, and the rest of Squad 7 set out for the turbo lift shafts. Obi-Wan hadn't gone 5 meters when he stopped and swung around.
Anakin, I know we've got a score to settle with Gunray, but don't make it personal. We want to take him alive.
Oh, but it is personal, Anakin told himself, while he watched Obi-Wan, Cody, and the remaining troopers disappear into the turbo lift. As he and the four troopers were exiting the grotto, the tip of his boot sent some object skittering across the floor. On the fly, he used the force to call the thing to his left hand and realized that it was Obi-Wan's rebreather, which must have fallen from its utility pouch during the brief exchange with the unseen battle droids. But no matter. Obi-Wan was probably already in the lower levels of the readout, where there would be little need for the device. Opening one of the pouches on his belt, Anakin wedged the rebreather inside. He urged the troopers on, and they stayed close on his heels. Upward. Following burrows, ramps, and shafts used only by droids. Through processing and shipment areas. Through hatcheries filled with squealing grubs. Upward. Into the Citadel's gleaming middle levels. Through rooms large as starship docking bays filled floor to ceiling with stuff. A boundless collection of junk, ritual gifts, impulsive purchases. Thousands of faddish devices never to be used, but too prized as possessions to be thrown out, donated, handed down, or destroyed. More technology than existed on entire worlds. Hoarded, stacked, piled about, crammed into every available space. Upward, until they reached the Citadel's semicircular projection of launching bays, which overlooked the surrounding lake and a ridge of forested mountains. Anakin brought his team to a halt. One of the commandos held up his hand, palm outward, then tapped the side of his helmet to indicate an incoming transmission.
The commando listened, then spoke to Anakin with hand signals. Gunray's party is nearby.
They're testing escape vectors for the shuttle by lowering the defensive shield and launching decoys. Turbo laser fire has allowed several of the decoys to get past our blockade and reach orbiting core ships.
The muscles in Anakin's jaw bunched. Then we have to act quickly. No one contested when Anakin held point position. Approaching an intersection, Anakin made a halting gesture with his left hand. He listened for a moment, heard from around the corner the telltale heavy footfalls of super battle droids. The commander to Anakin's left nodded in confirmation, then extended a finger-thin holocam around the corner and activated his gauntlet holoprojector. Noisy images of Newt Gunray and his entourage of elite officers formed in midair, hurrying down the corridor, tall headpieces bobbing, rich robes a swirl, safeguarded front and rear by burly battle droids. Anakin motioned for silence and was just about to step into the intersecting corridor when a banged-up silver protocol droid appeared from across the hall, raising its hands in delighted surprise.
Welcome, sirs. I can't tell you how good it is to find guests in the palace. I am TC-16, and I am at your service. Nearly everyone has left the home.
One hand clamped over TC-16's small rectangle of vocabulator. A commando yanked the droid to one side, but it was too late. Anakin leapt around the corner in time to see the Nymordian set off at a run, red-eyed, flat-nosed Gunray casting a nervous glance over his shoulder. As for the super battle droids, they had about-faced and were marching stiff-legged in Anakin's direction, and the corridor began to fill with blaster bolts. Qui-Gon Jinn hadn't believed in baiting, Obi-Wan thought, as he and the commandos rode the turbolift to the fortress's lowest level. Baiting implied a certain amount of advance planning, and Qui-Gon had no patience for that. He took situations as they came, throwing back his shoulders and striding boldly to the center of things, relying as much on his instincts as his lightsaber to deal with the consequences. It must have been difficult for him to have served under a methodical master such as Dooku, consummate planner, consummate duelist. Now, a Sith.
The next stop is ours, General,
Cody said from behind him. Obi-Wan turned, watched Cody slam a new power pack into his DC-15.
How do you want to handle this, sir?
You're the master of Warcraft, Commander. I'll follow your lead. Cody nodded, perhaps grinning beneath his helmet.
Well, sir, our mandate is a simple one. Kill as many of the enemy as possible.
As soon as the turbolift came to a rest, two commandos tossed concussion grenades into the corridor beyond. Right and left, battle droids were blown against the walls and ceiling. Obi-Wan knew, because the corridor quickly became a torrent of blaster bolts. He, Cody, and the others threw themselves into the horizontal hail. Repeating blasters roared to life. Staccato bursts made short work of the droids, but reinforcements were already appearing. Two commandos fell to fire, while Obi-Wan's team was making its way down the corridor in the direction of the Citadel's packing and shipping rooms. Halfway there, they encountered the contingent of super battle droids the Nymordians had sent to root out the infiltrators.
Looks like they've taken the bait, General.
Cody, Obi-Wan, and two commandos fought their way into a side room.
Another successful action. Now we just have to survive it.
Cody pointed to the entrance to a second room, opposite their present position.
Through there, a second bank of turbo lifts on the far side.
He tapped Obi-Wan on the shoulder.
You first. We'll provide cover. Go!
Obi-Wan shot for the room, deflecting bolts and mangling two super battle droids that stood in his way. The room beyond was stacked with coffin-sized repulsor lift shipping containers, constructed of some lightweight alloy. Shredded labor droids were moving additional containers into the room from an adjacent packaging area. Without warning, a battle droid appeared in the entrance. Obi-Wan glanced at the wall-mounted mechanism that operated the sliding doors. Adopting a defensive stance, he did just as he had done in the grotto, returning the first of the droid's blaster bolts and sending the second caroming around the room in a path calculated to disable the door apparatus. Things might have gone as planned had a labor droid not entered the room at an inopportune moment, guiding a levitated shipping container behind him. ricocheting from the floor, the deflected bolt passed completely through the container before it struck the door mechanism. The pair of sliding doors attempted to close, but the crippled container was now in the way. So they began to cycle through attempts to repocket themselves, close, repocket themselves. Each time they opened, a battle droid would squeeze into the room, firing away, forcing Obi-Wan back toward the entryway through which he had originally come, where a brutal firefight was still raging between commandos and super battle droids. While all this was occurring, something else was afoot. Strands of some gauzy white substance were beginning to drift from the hold shipping container. Obi-Wan realized instantly what the substance was. Taking one hand from the hilt of his lightsaber, he began to fumble for the rebreather pouched on his belt, only to find it empty. Star's End, he cursed, already beginning to feel woozy.
Sirs, this is a terrible mistake.
TC-16 inserted into a brief pause in the firefight. Keep him quiet, Anakin snapped at the commando closest to the droid.
But sirs...
A second commando glanced at Anakin and motioned down the corridor behind them.
Six infantry droids advancing. We're going to be caught in a crossfire.
Anakin gave his head a quick shake. Wrong. Follow me and bring the droid. Fury clouded Anakin's eyes. Lightsaber held high in his crooked right arm, he whirled into the intersecting corridor. Blue blade flashing, he cut a swath through the super battle droids, scarcely letting a shot get past him. The commandos following in his wake concentrated their fire on the ones Anakin only wounded. Their enemies fell aside, almost as if surrendering. Focused on the route Gunray and his lackeys had taken, Anakin raced through corridors, rounding corners without slowing down, sprinting for the launching bay at the far end of the final corridor. Confronted with an iris hatch blast door, he thrust his glowing blade into the metal as if it were living flesh. Lips drawn back over his teeth, he tried to force the lightsaber to burn a fast circle in the door. He brought his will to bear on the task, but the lightsaber could accomplish only so much, even in the hands of a powerful Jedi. When the commandos finally caught up with him, he spun to them. Blow the door! A commando hurried forward to place magnetic charges against the alloy. Anakin paced behind him, waiting. Another commando had to tug him to a safe distance. The charges blew, and the portal yielded. Anakin charged through the irising seal even before it had opened fully. The launching bay was littered with containers, articles of clothing, objects the Nymoidians hadn't had time or space to take with them. The shuttle was gone. Wisps of vapor swirled about, and the air smelled faintly of fuel. Anakin ran to the platform's forward-curving edge, eyes scanning Cato Nymoidia's light-riddled night sky for some sign of the fleeing ship. Anakin's teammates joined him at the brink, one with a hand vised on TC-16's upper left arm. What type of ship is it? Anakin demanded of the droid.
Why, I believe it was a Sheathapede class, sir.
Hor-Chal Engineering Sheathapede class transport shuttle,
one of the commanders explained. Anakin turned through a circle, gloved hand gripped on the lightsaber pommel, the other balled into a fist. Anakin began to pace, then stopped, yanking a commando around by his shoulder. Calm forward, command. I want my ship and astromech droid flown here immediately. One of the ARC 170 pilots can fly it.
General Skywalker,
a commando said from behind him.
Urgent from Commander Cody. He and General Kenobi are pinned down on level one.
Anakin shot him a questioning look. By droids?
A lot of them, apparently.
Anakin compressed his lips. All right. Let's go rescue them. Alerted by the commandos that the air was saturated with spores, Anakin had his rebreather in his mouth as he approached the room in which Obi-Wan had held his own against better than 50 droids, all of which lay scattered about the room. A weaving, shuffling, staggering Obi-Wan was dealing with the last of them when Anakin entered. When the final droid collapsed, Obi-Wan aimed the blade of his lightsaber casually toward the floor and stood swaying in place, breathing hard but almost grinning.
Anakin, how are you?
When Anakin went to him, Obi-Wan promptly collapsed in his arms. Anakin deactivated Obi-Wan's blade and inserted a rebreather into his mouth, the same one that had ended up on the floor of the grotto. Then he carried him from the room to where Cody and several commandos were waiting, some with their helmets removed. "Exactly what lightsaber form were you using back there, Master?" Anakin asked, when Obi-Wan had come around and the rebreathers were no longer necessary. "Form? More the absence of it," Anakin laughed shortly. "If only Mace Kate or Shakti could have seen you." Obi-Wan blinked in confusion and glanced around at the carnage of droids when a helmeted commando stepped from a nearby turbo lift.
"General Kenobi, General Skywalker, we've found something of interest among the equipment the Nymoidians left behind."
The fact that the Sheetha Peach shuttle had managed to thread its way through a storm of turbo laser bolts and dock in the core ship's portside command tower was no guarantee of safety. Indeed, while everyone was filing down the shuttle's tongue-like boarding ramp, the core ship was still being pummeled by fire from Republic warships. First to set foot on deck, Viceroy Newt Gunray asked for a situation report from one of the goggle-wearing technicians who was waiting in the docking bay.
"Even now, coordinates for the jump to light speed are being calculated, Viceroy," the nearest one said. "A matter of moments, and we will be well away from Cato Nymoidia. Your peers on the Council of Separatists await us in the Outer Rim."
"Let us hope so," Gunray said, as the vessel was rocked by a massive explosion.
Behind Gunray walked Settlement Officer Rune Ha'ako, wearing a crested skullcap. And behind Ha'ako, various financial, legal, and diplomatic officers, each wearing a distinctive headpiece. He called Ha'ako aside while the others were exiting the sterile docking bay.
"Do you think there will be a chance to return and reclaim what we had to leave behind?"
"Not a chance,"
puckered Ha'ako said flatly.
"Our purse worlds now belong to the Republic, and Nymoidia itself is under siege.
Count Dooku will help us find new worlds to settle when the war is won.
If the war is won, you mean. The Republic seems keen on driving us from the galaxy."
Gunray made a dismissive gesture with his fat fingers.
"Temporary setbacks. The Republic has yet to see the face of its real enemy."
Ha'ako hunched slightly at the reference.
"But is even he enough, Viceroy?"
Gunray said nothing, although he had been asking himself the same question for the past several weeks. One thing was clear. The glory days of the Trade Federation had come to an untimely end. Ironically, the individual most responsible for that bright burning, for the rise of Newt Gunray himself, was the same individual who had repeatedly betrayed him, and to whom Gunray and the other Separatists were now forced to look for salvation. The Sith Lord, Darth Sidious. Gunray gazed at the few possessions he had been able to gather. His costly robes and mitres, resplendent jewelry, priceless works of art. A sudden chill laddered up his spine.
"The chair! Where is the chair?"
Ha'ako stared at him.
"The Mechno chair,"
Gunray said.
"It's not here anywhere."
Now Ha'ako's eyes widened in apprehension.
"Surely we couldn't have overlooked it."
Gunray paced worriedly, trying to recall when and where he had last seen the device.
"I'm certain that I had it moved to the launching bay. Yes, yes, I remember seeing it there. But in the rush to launch, but you armed it to self-destruct,"
Ha'ako said.
"Tell me you armed it."
Gunray stared at him.
"I thought you had armed it."
Ha'ako gestured to himself.
"I don't even know the sequence codes."
Gunray fell silent for a moment.
"Ha'ako, what if they should decide to tamper with it?"
Ha'ako's broad slash of mouth twitched with worry.
"Without the codes, what could they possibly gain from it?"
"You're right. Of course you're right."
Gunray tried to convince himself. It was just a mechno chair after all. Finely wrought, but just a walking chair. A walking chair equipped with a hyperwave transceiver. A hyperwave transceiver given to him 14 years ago by...
What if he should learn that we left it behind?
Gunray rasped.
Sidious,
Ha'ako said softly.
Not Sidious. Count Dooku, you mean. Are you brain dead?
Gunray fairly screeched.
Grievous! What if Grievous should find out?
Supreme Commander of the droid armies, General Grievous, had been San Hill and Pago the Lesser's gift to Dooku. Once merely a barbaric living being, now a cyborg monstrosity, devoted to death and destruction. Already the butcher of entire populations, the devastator of countless worlds.
It's not too late,
Ha'ako said suddenly.
We can communicate with the chair from here. Can we arm it to self-destruct?
Ha'ako shook his head negatively.
But we might be able to instruct it to arm itself.
Sickle-footed, humpbacked, incised with intricate designs, the Mechnochair sat in the launching bay of the now-seized fortress, amid a heap of equally exquisite belongings left by the fleeing Nymoidians. Obi-Wan was circling it, right hand caressing his bearded chin.
I think I've seen this chair before. Squatting alongside it, Anakin looked up at him.
Where?
Obi-Wan stopped. On Naboo, shortly after Viceroy Gunray and his entourage were taken into custody in Theed. On the far side of the spacious bay, up on its hardstand, sat Anakin's sleek yellow starfighter. R2-D2 stood nearby, communing with TC-16. Anakin examined the chair's holoprojector without touching it. An oval of ribbed alloy, it was equipped with a pair of dorsal sockets, sized to accept data cells of some sort.
It is unusual. You know, Master, these cells could contain valuable messages in storage.
All the more reason to leave it be until someone from intelligence can have a look at it. Anakin frowned.
That could take forever.
Obi-Wan folded his arms and regarded him.
Are you in a rush, Anakin?
For all we know, the cells could be programmed to erase themselves.
Do you see any evidence of that?
No, but
then we're better off waiting until we can run a proper diagnostic.
Anakin grimaced.
What do you know about running diagnostics, Master?
I'm not exactly a stranger to the Temple's cyber labs, Anakin.
I know that.
But R2 can run the diagnostic. He beckoned for the droid to join him at the Mechno chair.
Anakin,
Obi-Wan started to say.
Really, sirs, I must protest.
TC-16 interrupted, hurrying behind R2-D2.
These items remain the property of Viceroy Gunray and other members of his party.
You don't have a say in the matter, Anakin said.
R2 extended his computer interface arm and inserted the magnetic tip into an output socket in the chair.
Anakin,
Obi-Wan said sharply. Anakin stood up and joined Obi-Wan on the launch platform. Obi-Wan was pointing to a blinking light that was growing larger by the second in the night sky.
Do you see that?
That is very likely the ship we're waiting for. And the intelligence officers aboard are not going to take kindly to our sticking our noses in their business.
Sirs?
TC-16 said from behind them. Not now, TC, Obi-Wan said. R2-D2 began to loose a long series of whistles, chirps, and chitters. If and when they give the okay, Obi-Wan went on, then feel free to dissect the entire chair if that's your objective.
That's not my objective, Master.
Sirs?
Keep quiet, TC,
Anakin said. R2-D2 honked and razzed, though as if from a distance.
And you too, R2.
Obi-Wan glanced over his shoulder, and his jaw dropped.
Where's the Mechno chair?
Anakin swung around and scanned the bay.
Where's R2?
I've been trying to tell you, sirs.
TC-16 gestured toward the launching bay's ruined iris hatch.
The chair walked away, taking your high-thinking little droid with it.
They rushed into the corridor, saw that it was deserted in both directions, and began searching the rooms that adjoined the bay. A prolonged electronic squeal brought both of them back into the main corridor. The protocol droid following behind
They hurried into a compact data room, where they saw R2-D2 with his interface arm still jacked into the chair and the gripper of his grasping arm clamped to the bar handle of a storage cabinet. Stretched to its full extent, a computer interface cable now connected the Mechno chair to a control console of some sort. "What's it doing?" Obi-Wan asked. R2-D2 chattered and wheezed. "What's R2 saying?" Obi-Wan asked TC-16.
"He's saying, sir, that the Mechno chair has just armed itself to self-destruct."
Anakin made a mad dash for the console. Before Obi-Wan could even think about stopping him, Anakin had leaned forward and wrenched the interface cable from the control console. R2-D2 yowled, and TC-16 moaned in distress. A web of blue energy gambolled around the chair and the console, knocking Anakin onto his backside. At the same time, a high-resolution blue hologram projected from the chair's holoplate. And to the meter-high figure in the hooded cloak, the unmistakable voice of Viceroy Newt Gunray was saying,
"Yes, yes, of course. Trust that I will see to it personally, my Lord Sidious."
These days, an appointment with Supreme Chancellor Palpatine was not something to be taken lightly, even for a member of the so-called Loyalist Committee. Appointment? More. An audience. Bail Organa had just arrived in Coruscant. He had been away from the Galactic Capital for only a standard month, and could scarcely believe the disturbing changes that had taken place during his short absence. Alderaan never seemed more a paradise, a sanctuary. Just thinking about his beautiful blue and white homeworld made Bail yearn to be there, yearn for the company of his loving wife.
"I'm going to need to see further identification,"
the clone trooper stationed at the landing platform's homeworld security checkpoint told him. Bail motioned to the identichip he had already slotted in the scanner. "It's all there, Sergeant. I'm a member in good standing of the Republic Senate." The helmeted non-com glanced at the display screen.
"So it says. You're free to go."
Bail hailed a free travel air taxi and instructed the droid driver to take him to the Senate building. Even outside the normal sky lanes, above the myriad and abysmal canyons that fissured the urban scape, Coruscant looked much as it had for as long as Bail had known it. Traffic was as dense as ever, with ships arriving perpetually from all points in the galaxy. New restaurants had opened. More art was being created. Paradoxically, there seemed to be more joviality in the air, and more opportunities than ever for vice. Even with trade disrupted to the outer rim, many Coruscanti were living the good life, and many senators were continuing to avail themselves of the limitless privileges they'd enjoyed in the pre-war years. From up here, one had to look closely to observe the changes. In the oval twin-drive air taxi, for example. Running in tiny print across the passenger's seat display screen was a public service ad extolling the virtues of COMPOR, the Commission for the Protection of the Republic. Non-humans need not apply. And there, dazzling the sheer face of a towering office building, a piece of late-breaking holonet news detailing the Republic's victory at Cato Nymoidia. Lately, it was triumph after triumph, praise for the Grand Army of the Republic, all glory to the clone troopers. Rarely a mention of the Jedi, save for when one of them was commended by Palpatine in the Senate's Great Rotunda. Bail stirred in his seat. Even Palpatine's harshest critics in the Senate, or in the various media, couldn't hold him fully accountable for what Coruscant had become. Though hardly the innocent he sometimes pretended to be, Palpatine was not to blame. His talent, for being at once sincere and exacting, was what had gotten him elected in the first place. 13 years ago, the Senate was interested only in ridding itself of Finis Valorum, Antilles had once told Bail. Valorum, who had believed he could put honesty on the Senate agenda. Even in those days, Palpatine had had a share of influential friends. Still, Bail couldn't help but wonder who might have succeeded Palpatine as Supreme Chancellor if the separatist crises on Raxus Prime and Antar IV had not occurred when they did, just as Palpatine's term of office was ending. He remembered the arguments that had raged over passage of the Emergency Powers Act.
that it was dangerous to change dewbacks in the middle of a sand dune. Back then, many senators felt that the Republic should bide its time and simply allow Count Dooku's movement to play itself out. But not after the full extent of the Separatist threat became clear. Not after some 6,000 worlds, lured by the promise of free and unrestricted trade, had seceded from the Republic. Not after heavily armed corporations, such as the Commerce Guild and the Techno Union, had partnered with Dooku. Not after the entire rimward leg of the Rima trade route had become inaccessible to Republic shipping. As a consequence, and by an overwhelming majority, the Senate had voted to amend the Constitution and to extend Palpatine's term indefinitely, with the understanding that he would voluntarily step down from office when the crisis was resolved. In short order, however, the likelihood of a quick resolution evaporated. Formerly gracious and unassuming Palpatine was suddenly democracy's champion, vowing that he could not condone a republic divided against itself. Rumors of a Military Creation Act began to circulate, but Palpatine himself had refused to come out in favor of building an army for the Republic. He left that to others, the Senate's nominal Sand Panthers. Finally, he attempted to arrange a peace summit, but Count Dooku had refused to attend. Instead, came war. Bail could recall clearly the day he had stood with Palpatine, Mos Amida, Malastarian senators, and others on a balcony of the Senate office building, watching tens of thousands of clone troopers march into the enormous ships that would take the war to the Separatists. He could recall clearly his utter disconsolation that after 1,000 years of peace, war, and evil had returned. More accurately, been allowed to return. Regardless, Bail had put his feelings aside and had played his part, endorsing bills he might have previously denounced, supporting Palpatine's efficient streamlining of cumbersome bureaucracy. It wasn't until passage of the Reflex Amendment, some 14 months back, that his fears had begun to resurface and intensify. The sudden disappearance of Senator Seti Ashgad, after he had argued against installation of surveillance cams in the Senate building. The suspicious explosion of a star freighter, aboard which Finis Valorum was a passenger. The passage of a security bill that granted Palpatine wide-ranging powers over Coruscant. The behavior of the Supreme Chancellor himself, frequently isolated by his covey of advisors and a legal cadre of red-robed personal bodyguards. His unbending resolve to continue fighting until the war was won. Gone was humble, self-deprecating Palpatine. And with him, tractable Bail Organa. Bail vowed to speak openly of his concerns, and he began to cultivate friendships with senators who shared those concerns. Some of them were waiting for him when the air taxi touched down in the broad plaza that fronted the mushroom-shaped Senate building. Padme Amidala of Naboo. Mon Mothma of Shandrala, human senators Tur Tanil, Banna Brimu, and Fang Zar, and alien senators Chi Ikwe and Sweet Kunkorkil. Slender, short-haired Mon Mothma hurried to embrace Bail as he approached.
A momentous occasion, Bail. An audience with Palpatine.
Padme hugged him as well. She told him she had just returned from a wonderful week on Naboo, visiting with her family.
An extraordinary world, Naboo, Bail said. I'll never understand how it spawned someone as stubborn as our Supreme Chancellor.
Padme scolded him with a frown.
He's not stubborn, Bail. You just don't know him as I do. He'll take our concerns to heart.
For all the good it will do, Chi Ikwe said, displeasure wrinkling her blue face.
You underestimate Palpatine's acuity, Padme said. Besides, he appreciates frank speech.
We've been nothing if not frank, Senator, dark-complected, bib-bearded Fang Zar said, with scant success.
Padme glanced at everyone.
Surely, faced with all of us.
The conversation turned to personal matters as they entered the vast building. They were an animated group when they finally arrived at the holding office, directly beneath the Great Rotunda, where Palpatine's human appointment secretary asked them to wait in the receiving area. After an hour of waiting, their spirits began to flag.
But then, the door to Palpatine's office slid open, and Sate Pestage, one of Palpatine's chief advisors, appeared.
"Senators, what a surprise," he said.
Bail came to his feet.
"It shouldn't be. The appointment was confirmed more than 3 weeks ago."
Pestage glanced at the appointment secretary.
"Really? I wasn't informed."
"You most certainly were informed," Padme said, "since the appointment was secured through your office."
Anger mottled Bail's bearded face.
"We're not leaving until we see him, Sate."
Pestage forced a smile.
"As is your prerogative, Senator."
The shuttle, whose landing lights had caught Obi-Wan's attention on Cato Nymordia, carried more than intelligence analysts and technicians. Yoda was aboard, eager to see for himself what Obi-Wan and Anakin had discovered. The technicians had succeeded in inducing the Mechnochair's holoprojector to replay the image of Lord Sidious, and Republic cryptographers, working with the Jedi, were confident that the unique device would yield even greater secrets once it was relocated to Coruscant and examined thoroughly. Refusing to let the Mechnochair out of his sight, Anakin had demanded to oversee its transfer to the waiting shuttle. Feeling unnecessary, Obi-Wan and Yoda decided to take a stroll down the corridor of Viceroy Gunray's now-appropriated palace. The venerable Jedi Master was pensive as they walked, the silence broken only by the sounds of distant blaster fire and the tick-tick of Yoda's gimmer stick as it struck the polished floor. Reaching the end of the long corridor, Obi-Wan and Yoda turned and started back. Without taking his eyes from the floor, Yoda said,
"Found something important you have, Obi-Wan. That Count Dooku is in league with someone, proof this is. That in this war, a greater part of the Sith play than we realize."
"Master Yoda, is it possible that Dooku wasn't lying about the Senate being under the control of Sidious?"
Yoda gave his head a quick shake while they walked.
"Looked hard at the Senate we did, and risked much we did by doing so. Questioning in secret those we serve. But no evidence we found."
He glanced up at Obi-Wan.
"Perhaps at Geonosis, an accident it was that Dooku revealed himself. Had he not, search we would have for Sidious, leaving Dooku to escalate his war. What think you, Obi-Wan?
Obi-Wan folded his arms.
"I've thought long and hard about that day, Master. And I believe Dooku couldn't help revealing himself, even though he may have regretted it. When he was fleeing for his ship, it was almost as if he allowed himself to be seen, almost as if he was attempting to draw us into an engagement. My first thought was that he was trying to ensure the safe escape of Gunray and the other Separatist leaders. But my instincts tell me that he wanted desperately to demonstrate how powerful he had become. I think he was genuinely surprised to see you turn up. But instead of killing Anakin or me, he deliberately left us alive to send a message to the Jedi."
"Right you are, Obi-Wan. Pride undid him. Forced him, it did, to show us his true face."
"Could he have been trained by this Sidious?"
"Stands to reason it does. Accepted by Sidious he was, following the death of the one you killed."
Obi-Wan considered it. "I've heard rumors about Dooku's early fascination with the dark side. Was there not an incident in the temple involving a stolen Sith holocron?"
Yoda squeezed his eyes shut and nodded.
"True, that rumor is. But understand, Obi-Wan, a Jedi Dooku was. For many, many years. Difficult the decision is to leave the Order. Influenced he was by many things. The death of your former master for one, even though avenged Qui-Gon was."
He glanced at Obi-Wan.
"Complicated this is."
Yoda gestured to a carved bench.
"Sit for a while, we will. Enlighten you, I can."
Obi-Wan sat.
"A stern master Dooku was, to Qui-Gon and others,"
Yoda began.
"Powerful he was. More important, convinced that lowering the shroud of the dark side was. Signs there were all about us long before to the temple you came. Long before Qui-Gon came. Spoke much of the prophecy, Dooku did."
"The prophecy of the Chosen One?"
the larger prophecy that unfold the dark times would. Born into their midst, the Chosen One is to return balance to the Force.
Anakin, Obi-Wan said.
Yoda regarded him for a long moment.
Difficult to say. Maybe yes, maybe no. More important, the Shroud of the Dark Side is.
Obi-Wan waited. Yoda grimaced.
Cryptic this conflict is. The way it began, the way it unfolds. Attempting to turn this war to their own uses, Dooku and Sidious are.
We'll have Dooku soon enough.
Lifted the veil of the dark side wasn't after your success on Naboo. Grown beyond Dooku this war has. Now to justice both must be brought. And to justice all those Sidious to the dark side has turned.
Yoda looked hard at Obi-Wan.
Uncover Sidious's tracks, you must. A chance this war to conclude. You and Anakin have been given.
In the reception area of the holding office, Bail Organa paced restlessly. He was preparing to vent his exasperation on Palpatine's appointment secretary when the door to the Supreme Chancellor's office opened once again, and his advisors began to file out between the imposing red-cowled guards that flanked the opening. Last to exit was Pestage.
Senators, you're still here, I see.
We're nothing if not patient, Bail said.
Just then, Palpatine himself appeared.
Senator Organa, Senator Amidala, all of you, what a delight to find you here.
Supreme Chancellor, Bail said, we were under the impression we had an appointment with you.
Indeed? Why wasn't I informed of this?
Palpatine asked Pestage.
Your schedule is so full, I didn't want to overburden you.
Palpatine frowned.
My day is never so full that I can't take time to confer with members of the Loyalist Committee. Leave us, Sate, and don't allow us to be disturbed. I'll call for you when you're needed.
Stepping aside, he gestured Bail and the others into the circular office. Bail took a seat directly across from Palpatine's high-backed chair, which was said to house some sort of shield generator. Necessary for his protection, as were the guards, though something that would have been unheard of 3 years earlier. Rumored to work for days on end without sleeping, Palpatine seemed alert, curious, somewhat imperious.
So, what matters have brought you here on such a glorious Coruscant afternoon? He said from his chair.
We'll come directly to the point, Supreme Chancellor, Bail said.
Now that the Confederacy has been chased from the core and Inner Rim, we wish to discuss the abrogation of some of the measures that were enacted in the name of public safety.
Palpatine gazed at Bail over steepled fingers.
Our recent victories have made you feel so secure.
They have, Supreme Chancellor, Padme said.
The Enhanced Security and Enforcement Act in particular, Bail continued. Specifically, those measures that permit the unrestricted use of observation droids and searches and seizures without the need for warrants or due process.
I see, Palpatine said slowly. Unfortunately, the fact of the matter is that the war is far from won, and I, for one, am not entirely satisfied that traitors and terrorists are not a continued threat to public safety. Oh, I realize that our victories give all appearances of a quick resolution to the war. But as of this morning, I was informed that the Separatists still hold many key worlds in the Outer Rim, and that our sieges there could go on indefinitely.
Is there not some other way than continued warfare? Bail asked. Surely Dooku can be persuaded to listen to reason now.
You misjudge his resolve, Senator.
Realizing that he had allowed the discussion to go off track, Bail said,
Returning to the matter of rescinding the Security Act, I serve the Republic, Senator Organa, Palpatine said, cutting him off. Introduce a measure to repeal in the Senate. I will accept whatever outcome ensues from a vote.
Will you remain impartial during the debates?
You have my word.
Then we've made a beginning, Padme said, just as I knew we would.
Returning to the launching bay with Yoda, Obi-Wan observed Anakin and Yoda trade the briefest of looks,
the meaning of which escaped him. Neither Jedi appeared to be bothered by the silent exchange, and yet Yoda doddered off without a word to speak with the intelligence analysts huddled near the shuttle's boarding ramp. "Jedi Council business?" Anakin asked when Obi-Wan joined him. "Nothing of the sort. Yoda believes that the Mechno Chair may yield clues to the whereabouts of Darth Sidious. He wants us to take up the search." Anakin didn't respond immediately. "Master, aren't we obligated to notify the Supreme Chancellor of our find?" "We are, Anakin, and we will." "When the Council sees fit, you mean?" "No, after the matter has been discussed." "But suppose one or two of you should disagree with the majority? Decisions are not always unanimous. When we are truly divided, we defer to Yoda's counsel." "Then the Force can sometimes be felt more strongly by one than by 11. Obi-Wan tried to discern Anakin's intent. "Even Yoda is not infallible, if that's what you're getting at. The Jedi should be." Anakin glanced furtively at Obi-Wan. "We could be." "I'm listening," Obi-Wan said softly. "By going farther with the Force than we allow ourselves. By riding its crest." Master Sora Bulk and many others would agree, Anakin, but few Jedi have the stomach for such a ride. We're not all as self-composed as Yoda or Master Windu. "But maybe we're wrong to attach ourselves to the Force at the expense of life as most beings know it, which includes lust, love, and a lot of other emotions that are forbidden to us. Devotion to a higher cause is fine and good, Master, but we shouldn't ignore what's going on in front of our own eyes. You said yourself that we're not infallible. Dooku understood that. He looked things squarely in the eye and decided to do something about it." "Dooku is a Sith, Anakin. He may have had his good reasons for leaving the Order, but he is nothing now but a master of deceit. He and Sidious prey on the weak-willed. They deceive themselves into believing that they are infallible. But I've seen instances where the Jedi lie to one another. We're lying now by not sharing our information about Sidious with Chancellor Palpatine. What would Sidious or Dooku have to say about our lies?" "Don't compare us to them," Obi-Wan said, more harshly than he meant. "The Jedi are not a cult, Anakin. We're guided by compassion and the belief that the Force is greater than the sum of those who open themselves to it." Anakin grew quiet. "I'm only asking, Master." Obi-Wan took a calming breath.
"Carries on his shoulders the weight of the galaxy, Obi-Wan does,"
Yoda said, approaching with one of the intelligence analysts.
"Ease your concerns, this news might,"
he added, before Obi-Wan could respond. The dark-haired, robust-looking analyst, Captain Dine, perched himself on the edge of a shipping container.
"While we still don't know whether the Mechno Chair was left behind deliberately, as some kind of trap, the image of Sidious is authentic. The transmission appears to have been received 2 days ago, local, but we're going to have trouble tracking its source because it was routed through a system of hyperwave transceivers used by the Confederacy as a substitute for the HoloNet, and was encrypted using a code developed by the Intergalactic Banking Clan. We've been working on cracking that code for some time now, and when we do, we might be able to use the chair's hyperwave receiver to eavesdrop on enemy communications." "Is the Mechno Chair the same one I saw in Naboo?" Obi-Wan asked. "We think so," Dine said. "But it has undergone some modifications in the years since. The self-destruct mechanism, for one, along with the self-defense gas." He looked at Obi-Wan. "Your hunch was right about it being the same one the Nymoidians have been using for years, and appears to have originally been developed by a separatist researcher named Zan Arbor." "Zan Arbor," Anakin said angrily. "The gas used on the Gungans at Oma Daun." He looked at Obi-Wan. "No wonder you were able to sense it." Obi-Wan stroked his chin in thought. If Gunray has had the chair for 14 years, then he could have been using it to contact Sidious during the Naboo crisis. If we could learn who manufactured the chair. Yoda laughed.
"Ahead of Obi-Wan, the experts are."
"We know who's responsible for the chair's Nymoidian engravings," Dine explained. "A Chi Charian, whose name I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce.
How do you know? Anakin asked.
The analyst grinned. Because he signed his work.
Protected by two squadrons of Trade Federation vulture fighters, Newt Gunray's organic-looking shuttle cut a blazing trail through the void of deep space, plasma bolts from a dozen Republic V-wings nipping at its upraised tail. From the bridge of his Separatist cruiser, flagship of the Confederacy fleet, General Grievous observed the whole mad dance. To any other spectator, it might appear that the Viceroy was risking his waddled neck, but Grievous knew better. Late to arrive at the rendezvous because of his decision to detour to Cato Nymoidia, Gunray was putting on a show for the General's benefit, attempting to make it seem that he had been chased to the Outer Rim, when in fact, he had undoubtedly allowed his hyperspace vectors to be plotted by Republic forces. More to the point, Gunray's vessel was in no real peril. Outnumbered by better than 2-1, and flying headlong into the vanguard vessels of the Confederacy fleet, it was the pilots of the Republic starfighters who were risking their necks. At another time, Grievous might have applauded their bravery by allowing them to escape with their lives. But Gunray's transparent attempts at pretense had exposed the fleet to surveillance, and now the Republic pilots would have to die. But not immediately. First, Gunray would have to be punished for his blunder, given a foretaste of what awaited him the next time he disobeyed a directive. Grievous turned from the cruiser's forward viewports to the weapons stations, where a pair of rangy droids were monitoring the pursuit.
Gunners, the Republic starfighters are not to leave this sector. Target and destroy their hyperdrive rings. Then you are to target and destroy one squadron of the shuttle's escort vulture fighters.
Acquiring targets,
one of the droids said.
Firing,
the other said. Grievous swung back to the viewport in time to see the half-dozen hyperdrive rings come apart in short-lived explosions. An instant later, clouds of billowing fire began to erupt to both sides of Gunray's shuttle, and 12 droid fighters vanished from sight. The unexpected explosions wreaked havoc on the rest of the escort, leaving the shuttle vulnerable to strafing runs by the starfighters. With the formation in tatters, the vultures followed protocol by attempting to regroup, but in so doing, left themselves open to precisely placed bolts from the starfighters. A consequence of the Nymoidians' reluctance to augment the droid brains of the fighters with interface capabilities, Grievous noted. Although they function better now than they had 5 years earlier. 3 more vulture fighters blew to pieces, this time due to Republic fire. Now the Nymoidian pilots of the shuttle weren't sure what to do. Attempts to go evasive were sabotaged by the droid ship's attempts to keep the shuttle centered in their shield array. Enemy laser bolts kept finding their marks. The destruction of the hyperdrive rings had alerted the pilots to the fact that they were well inside the range of the cruiser's weapons, and that they had to make their kill quickly if they hoped to escape. Jinking and weaving among the remaining escort droids, they pressed the attack on the shuttle. Grievous wondered for a moment if any of the pilots might be Jedi, in which case he would opt to capture rather than kill. The more closely he studied the maneuvers, however, the more certain he grew that the pilots were clones. Still, Gunray's shuttle was taking a beating. One of its landing appendages had been amputated, and vapor streamed from its pug tail. Grievous's eyes tracked the course of the imperiled shuttle. Count Dooku and his Sith master would never forgive him if he allowed anything untoward to happen to Gunray. Should the Nymoidian chiefs die, the Confederacy would lose a powerful ally. It was time to spring Gunray from the trap he had fashioned for him.
Launch tri-fighters to assist the shuttle,
Grievous instructed the gunners.
Target and destroy the Republic starfighters outright.
Deployed from the cruiser, a wing of the new droid fighters was soon visible from the bridge viewports. Alerted to the approaching tri-droids, the Republic pilots had sense enough to realize that they were severely outnumbered. Disengaging from the last of the vulture fighters, they began to make for free space, the nearest habitable planets, wherever their sublight ion drives could deliver them, since their means of jumping to light speed had already been destroyed.
Instruct 3 squadrons of the Tri-Fighter Wing to shield the shuttle and escort it to our docking bay. Set the rest against the fleeing starfighters, except for the ARC-170s. The ARC-170s should be lured into engagement without disintegration, even if some of the Tri-Droids are forced to succumb to enemy fire.
Grievous sharpened his gaze. The Tri-Fighters had split into two groups, the larger forming up around Gunray's impaired shuttle and pouncing on the retreating V-Wings, while the diverted squadron began to tease the pair of ARC-170s into duels and sallies. Without glancing at the bridge gunners, Grievous said,
"Finish them off."
Then, turning to a droid at the communication suite, he added,
"See to it that the Nymoidians are ushered directly to the briefing room. Inform the others that I am on my way."
Still shaken from the ordeal of transiting from the core ship to Grievous's cruiser, Newt Gunray sat restively in the cabin space to which he and Ha'ako had been shown immediately on disembarking. He had expected that a few Republic starfighters might pursue the core ship from Cato Nymoidia, and he had hoped that the appearance of those starfighters would convey the impression that he had been chased from the Nymoidian purse world. But the scenario hadn't unfolded as planned. What should have been a quick, effortless crossing had ended up a flight for life. It was almost beyond explanation, until the shuttle pilot confirmed that most of the Vultures had been atomized by fire from the cruiser's turbolaser batteries. Grievous! Castigating him for arriving late. Gunray would have liked nothing more than to inform Dooku of the General's actions, but he feared that the Sith would stand with Grievous. Every bit is shaken, Roon Ha'ako sat alongside Gunray at the cabin's gleaming table. Other members of the Separatist Council occupied the choice seats. The almost two-dimensionally thin San Hill, Ma'un chairman of the Intergalactic Banking Clan, the Skakoan foreman of the Techno Union, Wat Tambor, encased in the cumbersome pressure suit that supplied him with methane, the vestigial-winged Geonosian Poggle the Lesser, Archduke of the Stalgazen Hive, the stalk-necked Gossam president of the Commerce Guild, Shu Mai, the cranial-horned Corporate Alliance magistrate, Passel Argenti, and former Republic senators Po Nudo and Tikis, Aqualish and Quarren, respectively. Separate conversations were in progress when the sound of clanging footfalls echoed from the long corridor that led to the briefing room. Abruptly, everyone fell silent, and a moment later, General Grievous appeared in the hatchway, the rounded crown of his elongated death mask of a helmet grazing the top of the opening, his high-backed collar of armor reminiscent of a neck brace. Sheathed in metal, more suited to a starfighter, his skeletal upper limbs were spread wide, claw-like hands just touching the hatchway frame. His 2 feet, which also resembled claws, were capable of increasing his height by several centimeters. Legs of sleek alloy bones looked as if they could propel him into orbit. Beneath it all, encased in a kind of fluid-filled forest green gut sack, were the organs that nurtured the living part of him.
"Welcome aboard, Viceroy. For a moment we feared that you weren't going to arrive."
"And I can only assume that you were very troubled by the prospect, General."
"You must know how important you are to our cause."
"I know it, General, though I confess to wondering if you do."
"I am your keeper, Viceroy. Your protector."
Striding into the cabin, he began to circle the table, stopping directly behind Gunray, towering over him.
"I have no favorite among you. I champion all of you. That is why I summoned you here, to ensure your continued protection."
No one said a word.
"The Republic fools itself believing that they have you on the run. But in fact, Lord Sidious and Darth Tyrannus have engineered this for reasons that will be made clear soon enough. All is proceeding according to plan. However, With your home worlds fallen to the Republic, your person colony worlds throughout the galaxy threatened, you are ordered to remain a group for the foreseeable future. I have been instructed to find a safe harbor for you here, in the Outer Rim.
What world will accept us now?
Equine-faced San Hill asked in a disconsolate voice.
If none offers, Chairman, then I will take one.
Grievous walked to the hatchway.
For now, return to your separate vessels. When a world has been selected, I will contact each of you in the usual manner and provide you with new rendezvous coordinates.
Careful not to betray his sudden misgiving, Gunray traded covert glances with Ha'ako. The usual manner meant the Mechno Chair, inadvertently left behind on Cato Nymoidia.